I hope this talk is the last of the lectures. I hope not the least. And it's not designed to be a summary. Somebody said, well, I hope this is a good summary. Well, it's not going to be a summary at all. It's going to talk about chemical heterogeneities in the mantle and what we know about them. I'll talk quite a bit about the mantle zoo, and you have no idea what that means at this point. I show this mantle phases because it seems to be an obligatory visual for this meeting. It's intentionally dim and vague because geochemists have this amazing ability to measure isotope ratios to 1 part in 10 to the 5th, and that far transcends our ability to understand what we're measuring. Also, we have a deficiency in the sense that we can determine where things come from down to about 150 kilometers. So we work on basalts, and we can prove that they come from 100 or 125, 150 kilometers. Below that is terra incognita. Okay, we have no, as geochemists, we have no claim to be able to know anything about where material comes from below that. So we rely on the other disciplines, and we rely on fanciful models to tell something about where the stuff that we measure on the surface, how that maps into the deeper parts of the mantle. This is for the old timers in the crowd who miss having transparency lectures. Just to remind you, Sujoy and Sinti have gone through this. We have a bunch of isotope systems, strontium, neodymium, 3 leads, also hafnium, helium, osmium, you know, on and on and on. But all I want to say is that these isotope ratios depend on the parent-daughter ratio and time to first order. Okay, there's a little exponential in there. But principally, we're measuring things that have evolved over time, depending on the parent, radioactive parent, and the daughter. Can somebody just twist that projector a tad? Yeah, that's too much. Okay, perfect. And this, again, you've seen, but it just is a simple description of an evolution diagram for a particular isotopic system, in this case 87 strontium, 86 strontium versus time. We have a starting place back here at the age of the Earth, 4.567 plus or minus billion years. We know the initial ratio that the Earth started with by comparison with meteorites, particular types of meteorites. And we don't actually know the slope of this line. Okay, we know where we start, we know when we start. We actually don't know the rubidium-strontium ratio of the bulk Earth. That's because rubidium is a volatile element and didn't accrete or got blown off. So the Earth has a much lower rubidium-strontium ratio than the chondrites that we use to model the Earth. In any event, this will evolve to some point arbitrarily where we're going to make a few reservoirs out of this bulk Earth. If we, for example, separate continental crust or some enriched material from bulk Earth, then that new material, because it has higher rubidium-strontium ratios, grows faster, and what's left behind as a residue grows slower. And then this is where we measure stuff today. So this is the simplest possible thing, where we make an enriched reservoir, we make a depleted reservoir. You could think, well, this continental crust, this is the depleted upper mantle. It's not necessary that it's a simple two-box model like this. We could, at this point, make a whole bunch of boxes with completely variable rubidium-strontium ratios and fill in this whole wedge with evolution lines. Okay, And then when we measure things today, we would find a complete spectrum of strontium isotope values from the highest to the lowest. That would be the result of separating all these boxes at some time and letting them grow independently. We could also look at it as if we only made two boxes and then somehow contrived to scramble them before we measured them today. The outcome is exactly the same. In other words, it doesn't matter when you make the boxes or when you mix them, the outcome will be the same. And people don't like the idea of mixing things because they say, well, we just grow a bunch of boxes. Well, it's the same thing. So we'll be talking a lot about mixing because that's the bane of a isotope geochemist's life. Anyway, this is the simple model. Again, this is for the old timers who like transparencies. Same information. Okay, so what do we deal with to look at mantle heterogeneity? We basically use hotspots. These are surface expressions, volcanism, which, as I said, we can prove comes from at least 100 kilometers deep. Beyond that, we have to rely on somebody else's model. We'll come back to this in terms of specific hotspots. You notice a few things about this that are peculiar, at least they're peculiar to me. One is there are very few hotspots that are mapped on continents. I mean, is it really possible that all of that country has no hotspots? Well, everybody has their own hotspot catalog, so there are some people who would put hotspots through here. But it's really hard, much harder to identify hotspots on continents. The other peculiarity is that statistically, there are more hotspots per degree of surface area in the equatorial region than there are in the polar regions. I mean, that may seem, that's exaggerated here because of the map projection, but in fact, this has been looked at statistically, and there are more of them in equatorial regions. This is a fact that we've known for 25 years, but I've never heard an explanation for it. Okay, so what's so hot about mantle plumes besides that? This goes a little into my own personal motivation for liking to work on hotspots and mantle plumes. This is one reason. This is Tau Island in Samoa. If you look at my record, you'll realize that the hotspots I work on tend to always be in equatorial regions. Okay, so that's another aside. So if we look at all these hotspots, measure these isotope ratios, as I say, we measure them to absurd precision. We measure them part in 10 to the fifth. And I mean, we measure them so much better than what nature gives us for information about how to unscramble these numbers. It's a curiosity in the isotope geochemical community. Why do we measure things so precisely? We don't need to. Why do we do this? Well, I don't know the answer to that. I think you have to trace it back to the early days when isotope geochemists measured themselves by their precision, not by how well they thought about a problem. So this is a strontium-neodymium diagram, and you can largely ignore the actual numbers, okay? These are just different isotope systems. As was pointed out by Sinti and Sujoy, these two systems happen to be anti-correlated just because of the parent-daughter relationships in terms of compatibility. This is a selected set from Al Hoffman of samples, single sample analyses. Samoa runs this region. These are MORBs. This is Hawaii. These are meant to be the sort of extreme end members, which we'll talk about in a minute. Since this was made, Matt has extended Samoa, so it goes on out here someplace. But this is one end member, this is one. We'll go into that in more detail. It was, I forget, Sujoy or Cinti showed a histogram of mid-ocean ridge basalts compared to all ocean island basalts, and showed that, for example, in neodymium, there was some overlap, a fair amount of overlap in isotope ratio. In fact, a lot of these things, these samples, are from ridges that are adjacent to hotspots that have been contaminated. So there are various ways of filtering it, but if you filter it and get rid of those sort of hotspot affected things, this field collapses and there's almost a perfect bimodal distribution between these and these guys. Okay, just to lead you into the taxonomy of hotspots. This is strontium lead. Again, it's like a fingerprint diagram. Various islands or hotspots: Pitcairn. This is Lauihi in Hawaii. This is the Cook Australs, Samoa. And I mean, we can fill this diagram with these things. But the point is that no matter what isotope system you look at these things in, there are always extremes, and the extremes are the same in all isotope systems. So in 1986, Alan Zindler and I gave these things names, acronyms, whatever, which have plagued us all ever since. But EM2, enriched mantle 2, characterized by high strontium. Enriched mantle 1, characterized by low lead, 6-4. High mu, characterized by very high, 6-4. And mid-ocean ridge basalts, characterized by low strontium. Okay, so those are the four end members that we're going to deal with. This is, again, just a show copied from a transparency, again, so I just feel a little more comfortable. Two lead isotopes, okay, and we can look at these in any number of projections. And again, these spread along a sort of linear array. There are some things here I'll explain in a minute, but this would be the high mu extreme, EM2, EM1, MORB, and so forth. So that's just the taxonomic classification. So lead is a little peculiar. It wasn't described in any detail earlier. And it's a really powerful system, because there are two lead daughter products, 207 lead, 206 lead, that both come from uranium. Uranium ratio that parents to 238, 235 are fixed in nature with a constant ratio. Okay, that ratio changes over time because they have different half-lives. But the fact of the matter is they're coupled directly together, and you can't escape that. And this gives you a great deal of power. If we look at the evolution of that system, okay, uranium lead with these two coupled daughters, two coupled parents, we can start, and this is the beginning of the Earth, the primordial ratio. This is a lead that's separated from iron meteorites from an iron sulfide phase that contains no uranium. So the lead in that phase today is exactly the same as it was when it started, so we know this point. Okay, then if you make a system with uranium, for example, the chondrites, they will grow on an evolution line. Well, let's start with the Earth, what we think is bulk Earth. It will grow on this evolution line, which is curved in this space because the half-life of 235 uranium is much shorter. So it's almost dead now, so we're not producing much 207. But it will grow in the age of the Earth, which is 4.534, that's the time of core separation, to a point here. Now, if we were to put chondrites on this diagram, they would plot down here. They would be on this line, which is an isochron, okay? Isochrons, lines of equal age, are linear on this plot, and their slope is a function of the age. So this is 4.534. Chondrites would plot down here. They plot there because they have a whole lot more lead than the Earth. They have comparable uranium, but the Earth, again, accreted without its complement of lead, or the lead was put into the core at this age. So in any event, we have this, what we call a geochron, and this represents the locus of all points that the Earth as a bulk system must lie on. And it's inescapable. You can't get off that unless you do some really wild machination saying the Earth is not chondritic. Okay. So the Earth grows on this line, which we believe is the uranium-lead ratio of the bulk Earth, and will today lie somewhere here. We don't know exactly, but I would just restate the fact that the bulk Earth must lie on this line. Well, I've also plotted on this diagram just a random collection of mid-ocean ridge basalts and ocean island basalts. Well, you'll see that by and large they don't fall along this line. Means there's no bulk Earth lead available to us, that it's all been processed. So there are no things that we know on Earth, in fact, that have retained the original age of accretion. Well, this is a remarkable array. It's not as pretty when you look at it, when you zoom in on it, but in this perspective, when we are looking at the whole diagram, it's an extremely linear array. There are a few points down here that plausibly could be bulk Earth, but they have strontium or neodymium or hafnium that violates bulk Earth. So we, in fact, don't have any samples that fit all the criteria for being bulk silicate Earth. The other nice thing about this diagram is if you grow along a bulk Earth trajectory and then make a series of reservoirs at some time, okay, these are age tick marks, okay, 4.55, and they're getting younger, and this is zero. If at, say, 2 billion years, we separate bulk Earth into a bunch of reservoirs and let them grow independently, they will follow their own growth curves. If you make one that where you don't affect the uranium lead, let it grow with its bulk Earth ratio, it, of course, continues to follow this line. Other ones will deviate above this line and grow to here. Others will fall below the line and could, in principle, end up back here, but they don't. So the slope of this line is also an isochron, in this case called a secondary isochron, and it has an age, in this case, a best fit age of about 2 billion years. So, and it's a really important thing that the isotopic heterogeneities that are so clear in mantle-derived rocks, you can't make those yesterday. You had to make them a long time ago, or you made the parent-daughter separations a long time ago, and they've evolved into this heterogeneous mantle. Now, whether this mantle actually was formed as a catastrophic event at 2 billion years, for example, or not, most people, you can generate this same sort of pseudo-linear array by having a variety of separation times, and it sort of makes a small mess out of this, but this isn't exact evidence for a catastrophe on Earth at 2 billion years. But it's almost consistent with that if you like that idea. Most people don't. So anyway, we're going to focus on these things, but you have to remember while we're talking about them that there's a huge variety in isotope space, enormous variety compared to our precision, and they had to have formed from reservoirs that have been distinct from each other for a few billion years. And so one of the major difficulties for the isotope guys is how do you keep a whole bunch of separate boxes in the mantle somewhere from being mixed up and stirred and wiped out in by convection and mixing and so forth. And so a lot of the talk, I mean, I'll walk you through the Mantle Zoo, but the last part of the talk will be an attempt to show you what scale length these mantle heterogeneities exist on, and to look ahead to that and tell you that we don't know, okay? It's not something, again, isotope geochemists are very good at, and we have to depend on dynamicists and geophysicists and mineral physicists to try to understand that central question. Okay, so Mantle Zoo, this is just a three-dimensional plot. We've just taken three isotopes, and we're going to work in that space for a while. One of the leads, neodymium and strontium. So you just plot three-dimensional space, and the end members that we have identified, in a sense, we put these in space such that a polygon volume, which is defined by these four end members, will include all of the data that we've ever measured. Okay. So if you find something that falls outside, you simply stretch this corner a little until it comes back inside. So there's a little latitude. Recently, as I say, Matt Jackson has pushed this end member in this direction quite a way. So we've stretched this polygon, the tetrahedron, quite a bit. But these are the various end member islands. Samoa, EM2 is defined by this extreme sample from Samoa, but Samoa runs all the way back inside the tetrahedron to over here. High Mu is defined by the extreme by one of the islands in the Cook Australs, but there are other islands that drift down also inside the tetrahedron. EM1 is defined by Pitcairn Island in the Central Pacific. Again, as has an extreme, but it has a variety of isotope ratios. And then more, but we haven't plotted. This is a diagram from Rhea's paper in 2004. So just looking at a whole bunch of these tetrahedrons with limited data sets, EM2, EM1, DMM, high mu. Okay, so these are just looking, actually the tetrahedron is oriented, so the EM1, DMM, high mu base is in the plane of the board. Some people call these wormograms. Jason Phipps Morgan calls them heart tubes. I guess we could probably call them soft tubes, since we don't know much about where they come from. Anyway, Cape Verde's just a collection of islands, okay? What's really characteristic about the islands, the hot spots, is that they, if you do 40 samples, they don't just fall randomly throughout this tetrahedron. They are always associated in some way with the other samples from the same island. So they always form these kind of, not always, but by and large, these sort of lineated arrays. Iceland we'll talk about a little, and a variety, okay? Just to look at it, one particular version again. The three axes now, tetrahedron is oriented sort of cattywampus in this three-dimensional system. And just a selection of these islands. What was key, or what is key, is we know what the upper mantle is, okay? The upper mantle is this DMM, depleted morb mantle. That's about the only one that we know sort of where it is and what it is and how it got there. And the idea was these other things, by the conventional model, I'll show you the standard model in a minute, must then come from below here. That seems evident. The anti-plumers would have it otherwise, and we'll talk about that. So if you derive all of these other things from below the upper mantle, the idea was that these arrays then represented mixing arrays between a sort of a pure plume component and the upper mantle on the way through. But in fact, the mixing arrays don't point to there, and in detail, you can really show that that's not true. Even for Hawaii, which appears to be pointing there, it's actually missing it in three dimensions. So we invented a new mantle end member, which we call focus zone, for the focus of all these arrays, and just arbitrarily put it here. People have since, a number of people have moved this FOSO around because of their own predilection for what defines FOSO. So maybe it's down here, maybe it's over here, and it wanders around with time. It has a time dependence. But it's somewhere here. Okay, the essential concept is that it is a component that is a common component to all of these arrays. And it was characterized, or we discovered or noted, that most of the high helium islands fall in this sort of FOSO domain. Well, this isn't exactly corresponding to this, as you'll notice, but the high helium islands, Hawaii, and if you look at Hawaii, it's a long linear array, but it starts with low helium and goes to high helium. So in fact, as you progress down this array, helium is going up, which gives you the sense that it's headed for some high helium domain. Iceland itself has high helium. Galapagos have high helium. Now Samoa here, again, increases in helium as you, helium 3-4, as you go south on this array. And so it's, again, pointing to some high helium domain. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. When I first started thinking about this, you'll see all of the OIBs as of 1994 are plotted here as little black dots, and you can see that this region actually has no analyses. So that's kind of a convenient place to put FOSO. But I went looking for all of these, as many of these islands that were sort of down here as possible, thinking that I could prove that FOSO was high helium by analyzing those samples, and it basically didn't work out too well. But no, they're rare. If we were to plot, just for curiosity's sake, if we were to plot bulk Earth, our best estimate of bulk Earth on this diagram, it actually doesn't even fall in the diagram. Okay. So what if we look at the trace element, ask the question, what does the chemistry of these four end members look like? Does each end member, while it's isotopically very distinct, does it have a distinct chemical signature? And this is the dreaded spidergram, where these elements have been ordered by an arcane process by the trace element geochemists, and we refuse to divulge the reason for this, but it makes sense. So the upper mantle, which I said we sort of understand, it's depleted, and you'll see on the spidergram it's indeed depleted. This was partly responsible for the ordering of this, so there's a little small circularity there. But the other three end members, okay, that were isotopically really, really distinct, sort of look. Okay, you may look at them and say, wow, those are really different. Trace element guys look at this and say, gee, those are really the same. These funny negative anomalies have other reasons for being like that, so don't be particularly distracted by them. I think in this half of the spidergram, these things virtually, they're small little things that are different, but the overall shape is incredibly similar. So we can't appeal to grossly different kinds of reservoirs chemically to make these three end members. So they're isotopically really distinct, but they come from some kind of similar mantle. Right. N stands for normal. Normal morb, and you say, well, absolutely, Well, they would fill this region. Yeah, some of them look like hot spots. Some of them look like mixtures between hot spots and this thing. Yes, and there is clearly a range. Even this is just the average. They're sort of world average. I don't know what the two sigma limits would be, but they're totally distinct from these guys. In any event, and a big argument about how you would define N morb based on objective criteria. You know, the way I define it is, well, it has high strontium, so I throw it out. Well, but that's hardly fair. But life isn't fair, so. Okay, so the standard model for explaining these isotopic heterogeneities. Okay, this is a mantle tetrahedron, 4N members, bozo thing, which is high helium, sits inside the tetrahedron. Okay, so everything is fine so far. And so where does all this stuff come from, and why is it chemically different, isotopically different? 1982, White and Hoffman and White proposed that all of these N members were basically a function of recycling of junk or good stuff, whatever. And these arrows in the corners point to the identification of different parts of the subducted slab that grow to produce these different end members. DMM is the upper mantle. This is a spreading ridge subducting slab. So this whole upper mantle is depleted and gives you this stuff. If you look at the ocean crust, it tends to, during its alteration in seawater, it soaks up uranium. So it ends up with a high uranium lead ratio, which then grows to give you this thing. The two enriched components are enriched because I'm talking in standard model speak now, not what I believe. So you take some of the sediment that's sitting on top of the plate and you throw a little of it into the normal mantle and you make these two enriched things. And you make them differently. One is pelagic sediment, one's terrigenous sediment. These are sort of details. This model, when you actually try to model it with geochemistry and so forth, it doesn't work. Okay, that's a great idea because we know all this stuff goes down. So we know there are components like this that end up wherever in the lower mantle, hopefully. But when you try to model it, make the chemistry of what we see here grow to look like this, it just doesn't work. And the standard model aficionados say, well, that's because you do a lot of stuff to it in here. So as you put this down, the chemistry that goes on here is just unbelievable. You've seen some of the phase diagrams. I mean, the phase diagrams are unbelievable. We've got 17, 20, 25 different phases, degassing, devolatilizing, reacting. And so people pretend they know what happens to trace elements in this S process, but for me it's like, okay, whatever you want, I'm sure you can do it here and make this, but it's not a very comfortable model. But I would say most people still believe in the standard model because I'm not able to give you a better model. Rhea, in 2004, proposed a variant of the standard model just to explain EM2. And she basically used an underneath process. In the spreading ridge, you generate lithosphere, you trap some melt that didn't make it out, or you percolate some partial melt from the underlying asthenosphere, metasomatize this, put it back in the mantle. The metasomatic process is a process of enrichment, put it back in the mantle, and she showed that you could grow EM2. This guy here. So in a very different way, you, instead of using the sediments on top, which is subjected to this horrible process, she used the bottom of the lithosphere to generate EM2. That's a lot more comfortable. It may not be better, but it's more comfortable because we believe the bottom of the lithosphere escapes this horrible Cuisinart here. So at least we could predict, based on some modeling of, you know, partial melts and metasomatic processes and things like that, we could predict what we might see, and then we find that it works okay. A small problem with the oxygen isotopes, which if Rhea were giving a talk, she'd tell you about this problem. But so even this model, you know, there is no simple model that explains all of this stuff. And I don't know the answer to this. It's partly related to the issues of mixing and how you store reservoirs or boxes during mantle convection without letting them talk to each other or only talking a little bit and things like that. Well, this is to return to sort of the larger Earth. You'll notice that I'm going to rarely mention the transition zone. I'm sorry. But the transition zone is, in a sense, what divides, or this was, I drew this 10 years ago. And it, in fact, there are two halves, so there are two models on this. And there, 10 years ago, they were N-member models. One was layered mantle convection with an impermeable boundary at 660. Okay, nothing goes through. Plumes come from 660. There's a starting plume, there's a ongoing plume, subduction bottoms there, and everything is just contained in this upper mantle zone. Then there's the whole mantle model where subduction goes all the way to the bottom, piles up on the core mantle boundary layer, new plumes, old plumes, and obviously what we've been talking about for the past 2 weeks is the idea that, well, it runs like this maybe for a while, runs like this for a while, and switches perhaps in different places. You have this going on, different places you have this going on, and over time you may switch back and forth. So I personally, there is still a group of geochemists who hold to this model fiercely, and who will say nothing comes through 660. So this is a hidden reservoir. They make two-thirds of the mantle a hidden reservoir. Well, I find heuristically that's just pretty unpleasant, because that means we can never learn anything about the whole Earth. We have no hope. At least in this model, that's not a good reason for believing in a model, but at least in this model we presume that there is stuff that comes from the bottom, samples in some way, and gives us things at the top that we could use to interrogate the whole mantle instead of being limited. Since I drew this, and for reasons that totally escape me, there's a third school, so there's a third end member now to this problem, that says, well, these things don't exist. You have layered convection, no problem. Impermeable boundary, nothing gets through. But plumes don't exist either. That everything you need is floating around in this upper mantle as plums or pods or veins or whatever. Everything you need in the mantle tetrahedron, the isotope tetrahedron, exists in this upper wildly convecting mantle. And that's the anti-plume school. I call it the fan club. F, Folger, H, Hamilton, Horn Hamilton, A, Anderson, N, Natland. Those are the sort of protagonists of this anti-plume school. Fortunately, we don't seem this year to have any anti-plumers here. But I could sum up my feelings about the anti-plume school in one image. Anyway. But on the other hand, the anti-plumers would sum up us plume fanatics by saying, yeah, this is just what you guys are doing. And that's kind of the way I feel sometimes. It's just another. We have so many cartoons in this business, and it's because we actually don't know anything. So it's nice you draw six cartoons and hope that one of them will capture some version of the truth when we ever find it out. So this is the upper mantle depleted with this big primitive box, and this is sort of a layered model. This would be like the anti-plumers, only restricted to the upper mantle. We have stuff floating around in some other depleted matrix with enriched blobs, and, you know, on and on and on. I don't pretend this is nothing but to show you there are a lot of versions of what life might be like. This goes back to a paper by Alan Zindler many years ago, which came to be called the Paisley model of the mantle. And you see, you just basically, all the stuff you think you need, chemically or isotopically, you just throw it in there. And it's a whole mantle model. And this stuff is always there, it's always available. And all you need to do is melt it someplace, and you can get some variety of that stuff. Okay, well, so the real issue then is, we know there are these heterogeneities. There are 4N members, 5N members, 5 sort of reservoirs, and they're all floating around someplace down there. And we sample them in a particular way. But what's the scale length? This shows them pretty small scale. These are sort of 100, 500 kilometer blobs. Clearly, the scale length was designed by the size of Alan's pencil more than anything else. But conceivably, the reservoirs could be very large. And I want to talk a little about what we know about that. So whatever you do, you have to keep them around for 2 billion years. And you have to keep them around against this insult that is mantle convection. This is an old Hoffman and McKenzie 2D convection model, really, really simple model. They start with a black box, which I haven't showed, but the first time step sort of warps this black box, and pretty soon you get to here. And you see everything from these little thin tendrils to these big packages that are kind of hanging on. And so can we make a 5-component chemical mantle that will persist through this kind of a process? And you've seen, we've seen dozens of these models. This is not meant to be an Earth model because it's glycerin. Paper in Scientific American by Ottino. What he did was, and he had some pre-knowledge, okay, obviously, put in a couple of dye patches in a tank of glycerin. And then he pulled the top this way and for a while. And then he pulled the bottom this way for a while and ended up with this. And he only had to do 10 cycles of this pulling to completely obliterate this dye patch and do very little to this one. And he said, well, he put the green dye in an island of non-chaotic mixing. Well, he obviously knew where that was going to be. But, you know, they don't look all that different. They're spaced about the same way from the wall. One's a little deeper, one's a little shallower. I like to look at this just to sort of horrify myself about how we're ever going to figure this out. Another version just illustrates a few more things. This is an area where the geochemists are really, really hopeless. Okay. This is an area where the dynamicists could help us a lot, and potentially the seismologists. Put a blob of dye in, and you do this, you know, convection. And what you end up, there's the original version, and you end up stretching and folding it. Okay, we've seen a lot of that. Well, you keep this up, presumably it gets thinner, you spread it out more, and extend it. But at the same time, there's a process that is just a diffusive process. So whatever is going on here, which is just pure thinning and stretching, we need at least to worry a little about this diffusive thickening. And I'll show you in a minute, it's really easy to rule out diffusion on a scale length that's going to hurt you if things are big. But since we don't know what the size of these heterogeneities are, if they're getting stretched and becoming really, really thin, and we're looking at a box of mantle, one of the mantle end members, that is full of this really, really thin stretch material, then maybe we have to start worrying about molecular diffusion. The other thing that I worry about that I would love to see addressed by the dynamicists is if this material were to have a different rheology. In this case, he made a different rheology by making them immiscible fluids. But they, in structural geology, you go out and look at rocks, you see them, Boudinage structure is very common. So as you stretch stuff, it breaks up into little blobs. Well, if these have an appropriate rheology, I could imagine them just rolling around in the mantle and never being stretched because of this different rheology. So those are just ideas, and I think, again, the chemists have very little control over this. Mineral physicists need to work on this or help us, because this depends on rheological difference in rheological properties between these guys and the matrix. So let's talk a little about the diffusion problem. Okay, what scale length can we rule out as a problem just based on diffusion? So I've just summarized some of the sort of high quality diffusion data on different phases, different temperatures, different pressures, and so different elements, if you like. And this, at high pressure, this is pretty much all that exists. At low pressure, high temperature, there are dozens and dozens of studies, but these just are illustrative of what's going on. So at one bar, for example, diopside, 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 thorium, uranium, lanthanum, ytterbium. That's kind of a range of things that we worry about as trace element geochemists. And so all I did was extrapolate the Arrhenius lines to 2,000 degrees centigrade. And you say, well, that's pretty extreme. What I'm really trying to do is a conservative estimate of what's the largest scale length that diffusion will get to in terms of hurting you. And you see, well, ytterbium and diopside, 3 gigayears, which is really a long time, 2,000 degrees centigrade, we're still at 20, 30 meters. Okay, so for most of us, we go, okay, we don't have to worry about that. Silicon and perovskite, now that'll stay around forever in very, very small scale lengths and retain very, very small scale heterogeneity. Oxygen and periclase, ferropericlase, this would be a lower mantle phase, but in this case measured at 25 GPA. Magnesium self-diffusion and periclase, aluminum self-diffusion, not self-diffusion because it doesn't belong there, but diffusion and periclase, up around now 100 meters. Okay, you go to the extreme. The fastest thing going is hydrogen and olivine. At 2,000 degrees and 3 gigayears, you can diffuse hydrogen over 100 kilometers. Oh, okay, that all of a sudden begins to sort of hurt us in terms of keeping heterogeneities from losing their signature. Helium and olivine, 20, 30 kilometers, that's already pretty big because we do a lot of work with helium and heavy isotopes. So strontium is going to be down here, neodymium, diffusing almost not at all. Helium is going to be up here diffusing 3 orders of magnitude larger scale length. So why is it that neodymium isotopes and helium isotopes are ever correlated? Well, that's a good question. Now, Jim Van Orman made some... This is kind of a wild extrapolation. He took his data for periclase, which was done at 25 GPA, sort of 15, 1800 degrees, and he extrapolated it to the core mantle boundary. Now, so that's to 130 GPA and 4200 degrees centigrade. And that probably is a little excessive in terms of an extrapolation. But then... almost all of these are extrapolated in temperature. Very few, mostly they're measured in the 1,000 to 1,600, 1,700 degree range. temperature extrapolations generally quite good. The pressure extrapolations, many at 1 bar, a lot at 25 GPa. That extrapolation depends on knowing the activation volume, and at really high pressure we have no clue how that works. Above the transition zone, the general rule of thumb is that 1 degree in temperature can be offset by 1 kilometer of pressure. Okay, so in other words, 1 degree per kilometer is a wash. Pressure slows things down, temperature speeds them up. Well, 1 degree per kilometer is a little higher than the adiabat, a little lower than the solidus, sort of in between. So throughout the upper mantle, the pressure and temperature effects sort of wash each other out, which is convenient. When you start extrapolating from 25 GPa to 130 GPa, then I think that's... I mean, he was using some first principles calculations to do this extrapolation and so forth, but in any event, self-diffusion in periclase jumps from here to here. So we've jumped up 1.5 orders of magnitude. But we're still only talking about 400 or 500 meters of diffusive exchange. Magnesium in periclase on the grain boundaries, his experiment was really clever because he measured both lattice diffusion and grain boundary diffusion in one experiment. This looks outrageous, right? I mean, you're diffusing magnesium over 20 kilometers. Agreed, it's pretty hot, 4,200 centigrade, and it's 3 billion years. You shouldn't be, probably shouldn't even have put this on here, because grain boundary diffusion is fast. We know that it's typically 10 to the 4th, 10 to the 5th times faster than volume diffusion. The problem is the grain boundary volume itself is 10 to the minus 4 or 10 to the minus 5 of a rock. So in fact, those two things more or less cancel each other out. And the rule of thumb there is grain boundary diffusion in a typical millimeter-sized rock may double the effective diffusion. But it's not as if you're transporting any serious amount of material over 20 kilometers. Okay. There is some magnesium that will go 20 kilometers, but there's not enough of it to make any difference. So the conclusion I draw from this is that for most of the radiogenic elements, excluding helium, things aren't going to move very far, and we've sort of known this for years. As long as you make these heterogeneities larger than, say, 1 kilometer, they'll basically survive in the mantle forever. So neodymium isotopes in a 1 kilometer blob will be the same today, not counting for the growth of the neodymium, but they will not be exchanged with their surroundings. So we could stand to have these heterogeneities floating around in the mantle as, say, 1 to 5 kilometer blobs, and it would be okay from this perspective. Okay. Helium is a much bigger problem. I don't know how to understand why helium should ever look coupled with other isotopes. Well, this is just another way that you can keep things separate, and this is an old convection model by Christensen and Hoffman. And all they did was try to make an ocean crust and a depleted underlying mantle and make the density different. They tried to model the density in a realistic way to see if having heavy ocean crust would help it, would keep it out of circulation long enough to generate the lead isotopes that we think we see in high mu from the standard model. Okay, so Al Hoffman was the architect of the standard model, and his attempt to circumvent the mix-it-all-up problem was to get together with Uli and do a convection model where you made something heavy and it goes to the bottom and it sits here. And this is 206, 204 in this model after whatever, a few billion years. And you see the bottom has radiogenic lead, which is what you need, and so forth. That's not meant, this is one way of thinking about how to separate these heterogeneities. Let's go back to, okay, so what do we actually know about scale lengths from an isotopic point of view? Okay, I've already said that geochemists are really poor at knowing anything below 150 kilometers. So basically we have stuff on the surface, and we try to map that into some sense of heterogeneity or scale length of heterogeneity. So I show here, I'm going to show you two end members of this problem. One is global heterogeneity, and one is heterogeneity on a 50 micron scale. Okay, and they're both equally heterogeneous, which is, this is scary for me. Anyway, this is the so-called Dupol anomaly. I think if we go back to just the map of the hotspots, look at the isotopes in all of these, just plot them in a particular way, and it's just really these numbers. Okay, each island you average all the samples. So even though there is a variation in the island, you just average it. And then you take, you report the strontium isotopes to four significant figures, take the last two and look at them here. So the higher these numbers, the more enriched, the more EM1, EM2 type material. This was 1984 data set. I don't think it would actually change much if we were to redo it. So what I did was found, well, other people had found these sort of hot spots where there was a lot of enriched material. One here in the Southwest Pacific and one here between South America and Africa. It seemed to me that it was not just two hot spots, but there in fact was a belt, which I call the Dupol anomaly after Dupré and Alegre, who published a paper on this particular version, this particular hotspot. So there are these little bumps. So you're looking at a ridge in isotope space that circles the Earth, centered on about 30 degrees south, with a couple of peaks on it, okay, extremes. Now the extremes get to be really extreme. Since then we've sort of formulated the mantle zoo, these end members, okay, because these are averages per island, they've damped out the extremes. But if you were to just look at the extremes that define the mantle tetrahedron, okay, it would bring home the fact that the extremes in the mantle tetrahedron all lie in this so-called Dupol belt. Samoa is the extreme EM1, EM2. Societies are fairly extreme. Pitcairn is extreme EM1. Tuboy close by is Mangaia. That's the Cook Australs. That's the extreme high mu. And of course, Morab DMM is everywhere. But in a sense, this cluster right here includes four of the end members for the mantle tetrahedron. Other parts of the world, St. Helena has almost extreme high mu. There is a island here, Christmas Island, that looks very much like Pitcairn. So these things occur in different oceans, but they're all in this belt. There are a few exceptions. Hawaii has one small volcano, a few million years old on Oahu, that looks a little like Pitcairn. Okay, so it's not perfect. There are things that fall outside the Dupol that are a little extreme. But the fact of the matter is, if you just look at the extreme samples, they all fall in this so-called Dupol belt. So that's a really large, large scale thing. Pat Castillo in 1988 realized that these were correlated with what I guess had not quite yet been turned into superplumes. But this is a map of seismic velocity, I think, averaged over the bottom half of the mantle. The details escape me, but the slow velocities are, so these things are the hot spots that define the map. And these are the velocity contours, slow, slow, fast, fast, okay. And this then turned into Adam's African superplume. And this turned into the Southwest Pacific Superplume. And all Castillo did was pick the very highest parts of what I had mapped as the Dupol Belt, and that's one of them, and that's the other one. And so they're sitting right smack on the top of the two superplumes. So that's sort of the largest scale thing. No explanation that I know of. Got Matt, wherever Matt is. Oh. Trying to get Matt interested in figuring out why the Dupol is there at all. Okay, let's go to really, now we're going on the other end, the really, really small scale stuff. This is a funny lead plot, but don't worry about it. It's because the way this was done, we actually couldn't analyze the isotope we usually use as a reference. But 208, 206, 207, 206, these are all three radiogenic isotopes. So the mantle tetrahedron in this space is squashed and projected through the squashed part. So it's all in essentially a single array. Here's high mu, morb, upper mantle, EM1, EM2. And these just show some of the islands that fall on this array. And the reason I'm showing them in particular is because I want to show what happens when you, for example, go to Mangaia. This is a little island about 20 million years old. You pick up two basalt samples, bring them home, and you measure lead. And since this, over time, many, many people have measured lead in basalts from Mangaia, and they all fall in this little teeny field. Okay, this is large compared to the precision, but it's really, really almost a homogeneous island. So Alberto Sal, during his thesis, decided to look at lead isotopes by ion probe in 100 micron melt inclusions trapped in olivines. Okay, so that's like the smallest scale you can look at. And you might think, well, these basalts get processed through a magma chamber, they get well mixed in the magma chamber, and you should, by looking at melt inclusions, you should see nothing but sort of what you see in the whole rocks. And here's what he found in two samples of melt inclusions, basically half of the whole tetrahedron. Nothing more extreme. So the most extreme melt inclusion is basically on the average of all the whole rock samples, but running all the way up here. Not unique to Mangaia. If we look at Pitcairn, which is this field here, and this defines the EM1 end member, he did the same thing with Pitcairn, found a little more homogeneity, but stretching down there. So on the very smallest scale, we can have huge heterogeneity. Now, certainly we can't imagine a mantle with heterogeneity on 100 micron scale, because we just talked about diffusion, and that's not going to work. But understanding how this feeds into the system is pretty difficult. I don't have an answer for why these melt inclusions are so outrageously heterogeneous. This is a picture I stole from some talk Rhea gave sometime. It's not published. But it sort of shows this fractal tree plumbing system. And all I show it for is that in a fractal tree, you have different drainage systems, and while they may be close to each other, they can actually be feeding from separate trunks, so to speak, or feeding into separate trunks. So you can have two things in close proximity here and here that actually are feeding melts in two separate legs of this tree. So perhaps there's some hope of keeping sort of really small degree melts that are isotopically outrageously heterogeneous, keeping them separate and somehow having them escape the plumbing system. I don't know how to do that. It comes back to what Sinti talked about the other day, is how do you arrange these heterogeneities in the first place? What are they like in the solid mantle? But then when the mantle comes up, how do you sample them? So he's got a black and white mantle and just sampled this heterogeneous mantle with different size sampling chambers, so to speak. And in one case, the biggest case, you mix everything. And as you go to smaller and smaller boxes, you preserve the heterogeneity that exists. So a lot of what we see at the surface is completely modulated by the plumbing system during melting. Okay, and that's another thing that we actually know very little about. This fractal tree plumbing system is a great, I think, really neat idea, but how do you, can the seismologist go out and map that for me? Probably not. You can map it in exposed ultramafics, potentially. Okay, so plumbing system, and how does it sample a heterogeneous mantle? And this is just another problem that we have to look through. We have to look through the magma chamber. And this was a paper done a long time ago, 1987, I think, by Kenyon and Turcotte. And this is a dynamic model of how things mix in a sub-ridge magma chamber. So they assumed a spreading ridge was sort of a flattened cylinder of a magma chamber running along the ridge, and did a dynamic calculation to see what kind of mixing would take place. And they introduced the cosine variation in isotopic ratio, let this thing mix for 1,000 years, and then looked at the resulting amplitude relative normalized to what they started with, compared to the wavelength of the initial introduced heterogeneity. So in other words, they put in a 50 kilometer sine wave with a amplitude of 1, let it mix for 1,000 years, and it's basically gone. Okay, the 50 kilometer thing is gone. On the other hand, you put in 200 kilometer initial variation, you preserve about half of it. You have to actually get up to over 500 kilometers in this model before you actually can carry the original mantle heterogeneity through the plumbing system without disturbing it. Okay, so that's kind of tough. That means on a spreading ridge, almost no matter what you feed into it, if it's smaller than 50 kilometers, you're not going to see that 50 kilometer variation. This brings me intentionally to one of the projects we did in SIDERO 4, which was, this was a dynamical problem calculation. We actually went to a ridge in PETDB to see what the rocks actually were telling us. So this was a stretch of the EPR, East Pacific Rise, 15,000 kilometers of ridge, of which people had brought back and analyzed roughly 500 samples. So you'd sure like to have more samples. But they were spaced in a very strange random way. But what we did as a small group was to look at the isotopic character of those 500 samples and looked at it in terms of distance from every sample to every other sample. In other words, didn't just look at distance between samples as you go along the ridge, but literally just closed our eyes and said, this sample and that sample are 1,500 kilometers, and then did pairwise for 500 samples. So you get an enormous amount of distance information. And then just bend this, looked at normalized the observed isotopic variations in each of these length bins, normalized it by the mean deviation of all of the data, okay, median deviation. So it's just a measure of whether you're seeing any signal, whether it's been all wiped out, or whether you're seeing the maximum signal that's observed. And so bin to one, all these little bins, and these are the formal median deviation statistics and all the isotope systems. And curiously, what you see is from the lowest scale length to of order 20, 30, 40 kilometers, you're seeing almost constant variation, very low level variation. somewhere around 100, you start to see more and more of the total observed variation. And then over 1,000 kilometers, you're seeing sort of a constant plateau. So this was almost, at the time, I don't think we were cognizant of the Kenyon and Turcotte paper, but it almost exactly mimics that curve that I just showed you, that guy. Okay, I think I'll quit. This is a geochemist playing with the earth. Thank you. Anybody want to know about the Mantle Zoo? Very little, curiously. I can go back there, but looking at those wormograms, there are very few of them that actually mix between the corners of the apices of the tetrahedron, which is pretty strange. You know, what it looks like is you may have made mixtures between there, but the last thing that has mixed has pulled everything into the middle of the tetrahedron. Clearly, that tells us something about the order of mixing and doesn't tell us where. The question is whether this is homogeneous and relatively low isotopic variability because of mixing in the magma chamber. I think so. I mean, I think the comparison with the Kenyon study, the dynamical study, which amazingly comes out just about the same. When we went into this, I wanted to use this to prove that there were no heterogeneities of 5 kilometer scale length, because the anti-plume crowd and another subset of the geochemists think that the upper mantle has all of these enriched blobs floating around in it, and that when you sample on a ridge, you don't see the blobs because they're all homogenized in the magma chamber. And I was hoping we could use this to disprove that, but in fact, we can't. Christine. What can we simulate in the lab?
Like, can
you take a rock and melt it? You can melt it. You can partially melt it.
Can we have control experiments with melting in order to figure
out? Oh, I think we have tons and tons of experiments, controlled experiments on melting for the phase equilibria and for the chemistry and the equilibrium chemistry. But in terms of, if you're thinking of plumbing systems, there have been a few experiments to see, well, there are a lot of experiments at the grain scale to see how melt wets the grains, to see whether it forms an interconnected network or not, just to assess whether at the grain scale you have a permeable system. And I think by and large it looks like probably at that scale it's permeable and you can move melt. But on the larger scale, if it's fractal or whatever, once these things start aggregating and congregating, there's almost zero information. Certainly you can't do that in experiments. They've done some modeling in convection models. Mark Spiegelman has done some that show there will be a tendency for these melt pipes to merge and focus, and I think that's okay. But actually, to see this in nature is really, I don't know how you do it. I mean, people go to, you know, ophiolite, ultramafic map sieves and map melt channels and things like that, but I don't think that's a good analog for this. Tinti? No, we haven't done it. Matt has looked at, just like the lead study of melt inclusions, has done strontium isotope study of melt inclusions, and finds more, just for Samoa, and found more or less the same thing. I mean, he can tell us about it, but you find quite a variation within a given sample. Yeah, I mean, in that particular study, you take little sulfide blebs in a peridotite and look at them individually, and they're isotopically really variable. For me, sulfide's such an open system. It's so hard to keep it from talking to fluids and, you know, rainwater and everything else. I have a lot of skepticism, especially when you put it back in the mantle, cook it. By the time you're up to 1,100 degrees, the sulfide's molten, and the diffusion rates in them are incredibly high. So. I think for lead, there may be a really big problem. Once you interconnect a sulfide melt network, I think we're going to see almost a helium-type problem with the lead talking to each other over much larger length scales than strontium, neodymium, hafnium. But that's all in my head. Matt.
Uh-huh.
Yep. Yeah, this is not a diffusion process. This is a dynamic mixing process. Okay, the Kenyon modeling, it's basically advection of melt in the magma chamber with very small scale convection. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. The problem is this is 500 samples in 15,000 kilometers, and probably 10% of those or less have helium data, and, you know. Yeah, no, it's a good project. Spend another year. Jessica? Nobu's tried. Nobu Shimizu's done the same melt inclusion study for lead in some mid-ocean ridge samples. And I guess I don't know the answer, but he found, in my opinion, no variation beyond analytical uncertainty.
But,
Well, yeah. I guess I'm skeptical, but no, these were heroic measurements that Alberto did. I mean, you know, you have to collect enough data. You have to. The ion probe eats up material pretty slowly, so each of those points was like a two-hour run. By the time you're done, you're just obliterated the whole melt inclusion. Great thing to do, but you know. Well, I've never understood that, okay, just to be blunt. But the correlation of the Dupol with the two superplumes and the correlation of hotspots in general with the superplumes may just simply mean that the superplumes help to generate, you know, small plumes. that there's an association just because the superplumes are hotter and maybe they spawn other plumes. Why the two superplumes are sort of antipodal near the equator is, I've always been puzzled by this. I mean, you think of quadrupolar convection where you have stuff coming up under the equator and going down in the poles, but nobody ever runs a convection model that ends up looking like that, that I know of, except BUSA. Okay, so it's just an accident that they're where they are. I mean, just, yeah. Everybody's tired and hungry. Okay, let's have lunch.